How much does it cost? And if I pay cash for it, how much can I get off? Cash? The clerk asked. You gonna pay cash for all this, boy? I just might. Let me see now. The clerk gave him a figure. George did some adding himself and figured the quarters and halves would cover it. Okay, I'll take it. Well, you know this is for cash, you know. Yeah, I'll take it. George went out to the car and came back with a box of mason jars and set the jars on the counter. You got a can opener? George asked. He had glued the tops on to keep the money from falling out or a thief from getting in. They cut the tops off, and George dumped the quarters and halves out on the counter. The coins clinked and rolled, and George started counting. Inez stood looking first at the money and then at George. The clerk ran out into the street. By God, y'all come in here. You ain't gonna believe this. This damn boy in here got over $300 in jars. They counted out quarters and halves until George paid him for every bit. And when I left out of there, George said, he was still shaking his head. Inez, too. The pickers had more money in their pockets than they were raised to think they had a right to, and times were the best they had ever been, which said more about how meager the past had been than how great the present was. There was a war going on, after all. They hated that there was a war, but they knew that it made them indispensable for once, and deep inside, they wished it would never end. Atlanta, 1941. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. Things were spinning fast around Pershing, and before he knew it, he had allowed himself to be pulled completely into the bourgeois world that he had become besotted with, and that would be his ticket out of the world he had come from. He had been squiring around the daughter of the president of Atlanta University for 2 years now. The daughter, Alice Clement, finished Spelman on June 4th, 1941, and it was decided that it was time the two be married. Shortly after commencement, a breathless announcement ran in the Chicago Defender. Enlisting widespread interest is the engagement of Miss Alice Clarissa Clement, charming and attractive daughter of President and Mrs. Rufus E. Clement of Atlanta University, to Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, son of Mr. and Mrs. Madison James Foster of Monroe, Louisiana. The announcement was made on Thursday evening at a party honoring Miss Clement. That December, on the evening of the 23rd, a Tuesday, and not by coincidence the anniversary of Dr. and Mrs. Clement's own wedding 22 years before, Robert Joseph Pershing Foster married Alice Clarissa Clement and entered the insular and parallel universe that was colored society. Dr. Benjamin Mays, the president of Morehouse College and a celebrated figure of the day, married them. The groom was 2 days shy of his 23rd birthday. The bride was 21. The Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor just a few weeks before. But the troubles of the outside world were put aside that night. It was the social event of the season, played up in the Atlanta Daily World, the Chicago Defender, and the New York Amsterdam News. And here was Pershing, right in the middle of it. The wedding, Pershing began many years later. Can I brag a little? It was a monster. If you can visualize a Gothic chapel, stained glass windows, long mahogany benches, then a balcony. Pipe organs up the wall, a master organist. There were 8 bridesmaids and a maid of honor in floor-length white taffeta and with tiaras on their heads. They carried long-stemmed red roses, heavy in their arms. There were 8 groomsmen, including Pershing's brothers Madison and Leland, in white tie and tails. White kid gloves, Pershing continued. Patent leather shoes. We were clean as chitlins. As he recounted that day, half a century later, he would not for some reason speak of the bride as much as the details of the spectacle itself. The Atlanta Daily World reported that she wore a gown of ivory satin, its neckline embroidered with seed pearls, and a floor-length veil that fell from a crown of orange blossoms. The altar was banked with palms and ferns. Numerous 16-branch candelabra and 3 huge urns of gladioli and lilies, in what the paper called a setting of splendor and beauty. One of the groomsmen, Jimmy Washington, would always remember the night they got married, because it was beautiful, he said years later, and it rained in sheets that night. There would not be much of a honeymoon. School took them in opposite directions. Alice went off to New York to study music at Juilliard, an extraordinary thing for a young colored woman of the day. Pershing prepared to go to Nashville to attend Meharry Medical College, and the two saw each other when they could. It was wartime, and it seemed everybody was separated from their sweethearts. Alice completed a year at Juilliard, and then it was decided that it was better for her to stay with her parents and teach in Atlanta than to live in Nashville with Pershing, who was caught up in his medical studies. She would be in familiar surroundings in Atlanta. Her father could secure an ideal position at a public school there for her, and neither she nor Pershing would have to trouble themselves with the messy details of keeping house at this stage in their lives. By the time Pershing found out, it had all been decided. Pershing had no choice but to go along with it. What money he and Alice had was coming from Dr. Clement, and he was calling the shots. So Alice taught in Atlanta and visited Nashville when she could. After a visit in the early spring of 1943, Alice discovered she was pregnant. She gave birth to a girl that December. They named her Alberta Ann, after Pershing's beloved mother, Audie Alberta. She had a brown velvet Gerber baby face. They wrapped her in baby bunting and began to call her Bunny, a name that would stick for as long as she lived. Pershing finished Meharry in 1945 and moved to St. Louis to serve out his residency at Homer G. Phillips Hospital, the colored facility where Madison had served his. Alice was expecting their second child now, and her parents argued against her trying to raise 2 babies in St. Louis, with Pershing working 3 and 4 nights straight as a resident. "Why do that when you can live here?" they asked. "See, they can show you a million reasons to keep that daughter and granddaughter at home," Pershing said years later. They were logical reasons, and you couldn't beat 'em. That October, the second girl was born. Pershing named her Alice Emlyn, after his wife and the beloved sister he could never protect from the white men who called out to her in Monroe. Little Alice inherited her father's big eyes and sharp nose, and looked like a lighter incarnation of him. Everyone came to call her Robin, similar to Pershing's actual first name, Robert. She was born in Atlanta surrounded by the Clements, while Pershing was working the ward 24 hours straight until he was cross-eyed and crazy from it. "In the evening, when you got through work," Pershing said, "you said, 'Phew, thank God.' Then you run upstairs, taking your clothes off on the elevator, run to the shower, get you a gulp, throw you whiskey, and get you 2-3 shots. Towel around you and hit the shower. Then get out and get a cab and hit the streets. Anywhere. It didn't matter where you went. Let me get away from this. And then you had to come home sober. And you had to sleep fast, 'cause you had to get up the next morning looking bright-eyed and bushy-tailed in a crisp, clean uniform and white shoes. And you had to, 'Good morning, Mr. So-and-so.'" A resident ahead of him noticed his work and suggested he go up for a surgery residency when the time came. "You think I can do it?" Pershing asked. "Yes," the resident said. "Try." Pershing did as he said, and started a new round of training that would last several more years, and take him to hospitals in North Carolina and New York City to train in surgery. Soon he began getting disturbing reports from home. His mother had taken ill. It was cancer, her kidney. He left to be with her. She had prayed to God every night to let her see her baby become a doctor. There he sat, a doctor in training now, reading aloud the Reader's Digest to her. She tried to stand up to go over to him, but she couldn't. "What's the matter?" he asked her. He got up to kiss her on the cheek. She tried to speak. She was worried what would become of her son in this bourgeois world he was entering. "Baby," she said, "always be independent. You don't want to be dependent all your life and have to depend on someone else for a drink of water." Pershing kept those words inside of him. In a few years, he completed his training, and though she would not live to see it, he would become a surgeon at last. For a time, Madison was the only colored physician in all of Ouachita County, Louisiana, after a doctor by the name of Chandler died. Years before, two colored doctors had been forced out of Monroe, the author Ray Stannard Baker reported, because they were taking the practice of white physicians. So Madison learned to step judiciously in his practice. He tended to the students at a colored college out from town, and the poor people out in the country where the white doctors would not go. The country people paid him with the side of a freshly killed hog until they could get the money, which some never did. When Madison's patients needed to go to the hospital, Madison could not admit them. He was not allowed in the hospital to practice. So he carried a hospital in his medical bag and made the front room of every shotgun cabin an operating room. Madison had his hands full, and he enlisted Pershing's help with his patients out in the countryside when Pershing was on break from his residency. Pershing was glad to help, but he did not want to be a country doctor. And he was thinking even then that he would have to get out of Monroe to be the doctor and the man he knew he could be. He wanted the shiny fixtures of a modern hospital and a staff of nurses at his side that he could direct like an orchestra. Pershing was visiting once when someone sent for him to deliver a baby out in the country. He arrived with his satchel. Someone met him at the door. "Doc, I think she's ready." The fireplace was spitting ashes. The woman's kinfolk stood drinking strong coffee and waiting for the woman to pass the baby. Pershing saw her splayed flat on a cot, looking ready to burst. He set down his satchel and went over to her. He reviewed in his head the principles of the obstetrics course he had only recently completed. There was no point in pining for the trappings of a modern hospital or the equipment he was used to in medical school. He would have to make do with whatever was in the cabin and his medical bag. They would get through it somehow. He reached toward her and felt for the hard surface of a human head at the beginning of life. The woman bore down and grunted. He, in turn, made note of the contractions and the baby's position. He tried to help her bear down, but the baby didn't come. The woman had been through more births than Pershing had, and could sense the tentative touch of a book-learned delivery. All this analysis, and still no baby. "That's all right, Doc," she finally said. "Get on out the way." She rolled her round body off the edge of the cot. She grunted and squatted on the bare surface of the floor and pushed hard. Pershing watched and did as she said. "Come on now," she said. "Catch it." He moved into position. A few grunts more, and the baby plopped into his hands. Shoop! Bingo! The woman paid what she could, which in the usual currency was not much more than food and a promise, but was beyond calculating when it came to wisdom. He learned that all the book knowledge and equipment in the world didn't make you a good doctor if you didn't know what you were doing or listen to your patients. He learned a lesson that night that would stay with him for the rest of his life and would pay off in ways he couldn't imagine. Things appeared to be looking up for Pershing. He had traveled across the South for his degrees, been to St. Louis, spent summers picking tobacco in Connecticut with other Morehouse students, visited New York, seen the differences between North and South, and now, having deferred his military duty during medical school, was reporting to Fort Sam Houston, Texas, for a training course for Army medical officers about to begin their tours. He would be called Captain Foster, and it was from his short time in the Army that he would plot the rest of his life. He was bright and earnest, and while that didn't always get him what he wanted or deserved in the Jim Crow South, he was getting a break now, it seemed. The colonel, impressed with him, pulled him aside and suggested that Pershing could well make chief of surgery at his new posting. "Foster, you're the only colored officer with surgical training here," the colonel said. "You don't get this often, but I'm going to give you first choice." Pershing threw his shoulders back. "Thank you, Colonel," Pershing said. "All right. Now what are my choices?" World War II was over, and another smaller one was brewing in Korea. He could go on to Korea, stay in the South at Fort Sam Houston, or go to Austria, a base of the European theater. The colonel encouraged him to go to Austria, and that's what Pershing chose. Thousands of colored soldiers had preceded him overseas during the two great wars, more than a million in World War II alone, and that service had been a defining experience for many of them. They were forced into segregated units and often given the most menial tasks or the most dangerous infantry tours. But they also experienced relief from Jim Crow in those European villages, were recognized as liberating Americans rather than lower-caste colored men, and felt pride in what their uniform represented. They returned home to a Jim Crow South that expected them to go back to the servile position they left. Most resented it and wanted to be honored for risking their lives for their country rather than attacked for being uppity. Some survived the war only to lose their lives to Jim Crow. In the spring of 1919, a colored soldier named Wilbur Little returned home to Blakely, Georgia, after a tour of duty in World War I. A band of white men saw him at the train station in his uniform. They ordered him to take it off and walk home in his underwear. He refused. Soon, anonymous notes were warning him to leave town if he wanted to wear his uniform. Days later, a mob attacked him as he greeted friends, congratulating him on his achievements. He was found beaten to death on the outskirts of town. He was wearing his uniform. He had survived the war only to be killed at home. Cases like that were cause enough for some men to go north. Pershing put those things aside and chose to revel in the idea that he could actually be chief of surgery. Alice was elated. They'd been married for 8 years now, and had never lived together more than a few weeks at a time. The two girls, Bunny and Robin, were just about school age now. Alice had been rearing them in Atlanta with her parents, while Pershing did his medical training in different parts of the South. Now the four of them could be a family. They arrived just outside Salzburg, and Pershing went straight to his new commanding officer. He wanted to make a good impression. "Captain Foster has reported for duty, sir," he said. The new colonel was from Mississippi, and in an instant, Pershing found himself hurled back to the South. The colonel had not expected his new surgeon to be colored, nor had he been told that this colored surgeon was supposed to be in charge, or if he did know, he chose to ignore it. He told Pershing he had nothing for him to do. "Why don't you go out?" the colonel said. "Can't you go somewhere? Come back in a week." "Well, I don't have any money," Pershing said. "I've come all the way from Fort Houston, and the next payday hasn't come, colonel." The southern colonel had no assignment for him, so Pershing had no choice but to wait until the following week. When he returned, he learned there would be no leadership position for him. A white officer would be chief of surgery, as it had always been. Pershing would have no title other than staff doctor. Jim Crow had followed him across the Atlantic, and it was hitting him that he would never get ahead as long as these apostles of Jim Crow were over him. Still, he dutifully made his rounds when it was his turn, tending to the basic needs of the soldiers, itching to do something more in keeping with his credentials. It turned out that many of the patients were soldiers' wives, with gynecological or obstetrical complications that called for interventions that by now he was well equipped to handle. But for one reason or another, a superior officer always seemed to intervene and never let him treat the white ones. One day, a patient was in labor on his watch. The nurse thought it might be time. Pershing said it was still too soon. "She's not quite ready yet," he told the nurse. "Watch her close now." Other doctors tended to deliver when it was most convenient, pump general anesthesia into the patient and get it over with, he recalled years later. Cesarean sections were all the rage. But Pershing had learned from the woman in the cabin back in Louisiana that everything had its own time. He liked to let a baby come when it was ready. Others said he let the labor go on too long. But he thought it was a more welcoming way for one to enter the world if one were not rushed into it. So while other doctors relied on general anesthesia, he preferred local for the sake of the mother and the baby. A white doctor of his same rank caught wind of the delay. He stepped in over Pershing's head and delivered the baby as Pershing watched, too hurt to speak and not daring to. Never was there a rule written down somewhere, but that was how it played out. "You make the rounds," Pershing said years later, "and you're standing behind other doctors, and they're talking about your patient." He was noticing it more and more, like how whenever a white woman needed surgery, they never let him in the operating room. They sent him over to operate on the men. It was Jim Crow all over again, and he thought again about his short and long-term prospects. It was reminding him that he had a decision to make. When he got out of the army, he would get as far away from Jim Crow's disciples as he could. For now, he had no choice. He was under these people and had to make the best of it. He pushed the hurt and anger inside himself and decided that if all they would let him do was take somebody's pulse, he would take it better than any doctor there. And so he doted on the few patients he got. "I treated every white boy like he was the king of Siam," he said, "and didn't lose dignity. It's a fine art." It all changed one day when a woman in labor suddenly stopped contracting. It was another doctor's patient, the one who had intervened when he thought Pershing had let a labor go on too long. The doctor was getting second opinions and let Pershing come in this time. Pershing saw the woman on the operating table in preparation for a C-section. He looked the patient over and gave his diagnosis. "She's in uterine inertia," Pershing said. "The uterus is tired. It stopped pushing. You need to start a glucose drip of Pitocin to make the uterus start contracting." The doctor decided to try it. The nurses later went to Pershing and gave him the news. "The baby's crawling," they said. The baby came. One evening soon afterward, he and Alice were at dinner in the officers' club. The waiter asked what they were drinking and soon reappeared with another round. "Compliments of the lieutenant over there," the waiter said. Pershing reached for Alice's hand. They danced their way over to the table where the lieutenant, a white man from Kentucky, was sitting with his wife. "You wouldn't remember me," the wife said, "but I'm the patient whose baby you just delivered. I must give you a kiss for saving me from a C-section." She gave him a kiss in front of everyone. "You were the talk of the commissary," she said. People were taking notice. He was young, charming, and brilliant. People saw him in line, and tittered about him. "I hear we got a new doctor, and he's colored," people were saying. "Would you have a colored doctor deliver your baby?" somebody else would throw in. Chickasaw County, Mississippi, Fall 1937. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. The men who pounded on Ida Mae's door that black night, who raised a chain up to her, frightening her and the children and her sister-in-law Indiana, who slept by the door, went and hunted down her husband's cousin Joe Lee over the turkeys that had disappeared. They tied Joe Lee's hands behind him with hog wire and took him to the woods out by Houston a few miles away. They tied him up for stealing Addie B's turkeys, which belonged to Mr. Ed. Joe Lee did not work for Mr. Ed. His father had a piece of land he farmed on his own. But it didn't matter, because any boss man in the ruling class could claim jurisdiction when he pleased. A colored man a few miles west of here was whipped when he asked a storekeeper for a receipt. If what Addie B. said was true, Joe Lee had committed a serious crime against Mr. Ed, and it didn't matter who he worked for. So they took him out to the woods. They laid him across a log by the schoolhouse. They beat him with the chains that Willie Jim had raised up to Ida Mae. And when he said he didn't know anything about any turkeys, they paid it no mind. They beat him until his coveralls turned red with blood and stuck to the surface of his skin as if with adhesive. Then they took him to the Chickasaw County Jail and left him bleeding alone in the cell. The next morning, Addie B's turkeys wandered back on their own to her cabin across the field. They had been roosting in the countryside and came cawing and clucking before George and Ida Mae knew why Joe Lee was captured in the first place or what had become of him. There were no apologies. Sometimes they just got the wrong man. Joe Lee was known for taking what wasn't his, but this was one time when he hadn't. George went to Mr. Ed first thing in the morning to find out what happened and where his cousin was and to register his discontent. Ida Mae didn't want him going in the state of mind he was in and told him to mind his words. He had to walk a thin line between being a man and acting a slave. Step too far on one side and he couldn't live with himself. Step too far on the other and he might not live at all. He got there and asked Mr. Ed what happened. "Where is Joe Lee?" George asked. "We tried to wait till you got there," Mr. Ed said. George thought it best not to press the matter of what happened to Joe Lee. All these years he had been loyal to Mr. Ed, and Mr. Ed had been fair with him. So he spoke only as a husband and father, which he felt was within his right. "Very idea you upsettin' my family," he said, looking down as he prepared to leave and not quite knowing what else to do. Joe Lee survived the night. The boss man told George to go get him at the jail. George, Willie, Saint, and the other colored men on the plantation took grease to peel the overalls off him, just as their slave forefathers had done after whippings generations before. They carried Joe Lee back to his father's farm in the fresh clothes they put on him, and the people went back to picking cotton. The lash wounds on Joe Lee's back healed in time. But Joe Lee was never right again, people said. And in a way, neither was George. On the drive back home, George searched himself hard and deep. This wasn't the first beating, and it wouldn't be the last. Joe Lee had survived, but he just as easily could have died. And there was not a thing anybody could do about it. As it was, Ida Mae felt George was in danger for asking Mr. Ed about it at all. Next time, it could be him. George had a brother in Chicago. Ida Mae's big sister Irene was in Milwaukee, and he had been agitating for them to come north. He made up his mind on the way back. He drove into the yard and went into the cabin to break the news to Ida Mae. "This the last crop we makin'," he said. Eustis, Florida, 1944. George Swanson Starling. Word spread through the citrus groves that a cell of pickers had taken to demanding 22 cents a box and refusing to pick if they didn't get it. It was a miracle wage, and soon other pickers were trying to join Little George's roving union. But some got scared at the way George talked to the white people like he was equal and never went picking with him again. The foreman who assembled the crews and oversaw the citrus harvest knew they were in for a long day when they saw George, Mudd, and Sam awaiting pickup with the other hungry workers at the corner of Bates and Palmetto. Most foremen had little sympathy for the pickers. Their job was to get the fruit out of the trees as fast as they could, and this back and forth over pay was wasting time. Even worse, these boys had no business telling white men what to do. Most foremen told the pickers to take whatever the packing houses were offering. The Bly brothers were different. They were among the few colored foremen around and had grown up with most of the pickers. Reuben, who towered over most men and had a way of making women forget their husbands. Babe, who liked to gamble and hunt possum. And Whisper, who could speak no louder than that because he had got his throat cut, had been pickers themselves and knew the packing houses could pay more if they wanted to. Florida growers were grossing $50 million a year from that fruit back in the 40s, and the brothers felt the pickers deserved better. After assessing a grove, George and the Bly brothers conferred on the price the pickers should ask for. Then the brothers went and told the packing house it looked like the pickers flat out wouldn't work if they didn't get their price, and they didn't know what had got into them. The Bly brothers hoped to convince the packing houses that with the war on, there weren't enough good pickers to choose from, and they were stuck with whoever was left, crazy though these pickers may be, that the packing houses needed to think about paying more if they wanted the fruit out of the trees, at least for now. Of course, the Bly brothers, being colored and walking a fine line themselves, didn't put it like that. They just said the pickers were refusing, and they didn't know what in the world had got into them. Back in the groves, the brothers confided to George, Mudd, and Sam that they were within their rights to ask, and that there was room to maneuver. The packing houses were wringing the most they could out of all of them, including the Bly brothers, who had reason to believe they themselves weren't getting paid what the white foremen were, this being the South in the 1940s. The grove owners and their packing houses had a near monopoly on the growing and selling of citrus. They were among the richest men in Central Florida. Their European vacations and their daughters' cotillions and the visits of their children from the best boarding schools in the South were all chronicled in the local papers that everyone, including workers like the Bly brothers and George, could read. It was a multi-million dollar industry fed by the demands of wealthy and middle-class families from Chicago to Long Island, who expected orange juice with their toast and coffee every morning. The brothers urged the three men and their frightened, thrown-together crew of pickers to stand their ground. "Man, sock it to 'em, sock it to 'em," Reuben told George, knowing how much the grove owners were making off the fruit and that they were likely cheating them all. "Don't pick it no less," Whisper said. "Don't pick it no less than 22 cents. God damn it, I'ma tell the man y'all ain't gonna do it." Most times, George, Mudd, and Sam got their price right there on the spot. But sometimes they didn't. They couldn't depend on getting the Bly brothers as their foreman every time. And when they didn't, some foremen just said no without telling the packing house at all. Some went to the packing house, but accepted whatever the packing house told them. Others went ahead and sent the truck back to the packing house empty of fruit, and waited to see what the owners said. Sometimes the packing houses relented. But sometimes the driver would come back from the packing house saying, "Well, they say they not gonna pay that." The pickers dragged back to the truck when that happened, for the empty-handed ride back to town. George started to climb up with them, but most foremen weren't like the Bly brothers and wouldn't let him on the truck if he told the crew not to pick. You big with your big mouth self, one foreman said. You get back to town best way you can. And so George had to thumb a ride for 30 or 40 miles after facing down a foreman while his followers rumbled past him on the flatbed of the truck. He was developing a reputation for stirring up trouble in the groves. These walkouts were beginning to look something like a union. The grove owners didn't like unions, didn't allow unions, and weren't going to stand for it, especially from a band of colored pickers trying to take advantage of the war. Inez was scared for her husband, but too disgusted to let it show. Didn't he realize that he was colored in the South? Why couldn't he be satisfied like everybody else? Big George had been working with them when Little George stood up to a foreman in Orlando. The next day, Big George begged off. "I ain't going with you," he said. "Y'all too crazy." He knew, and everyone else knew, that every time George went out to the groves standing up to packing houses, he was pushing the limits of what a colored man in Florida in the 1940s was allowed to get away with. In the months that George had been rousing up the pickers, their world had grown even more dangerous due to the state's desperate wartime need for labor. From the Panhandle to the Everglades, Florida authorities were now arresting colored men off the street and in their homes if they were caught not working. Charged with vagrancy, the men were assessed fines of several weeks' pay and made to pick fruit or cut sugarcane to work off the debt if they did not have the money, which few of them did, and as the authorities fully anticipated. Those captured were hauled to remote plantations or turpentine camps, held by force, and beaten or shot if they tried to escape. It was an illegal form of contemporary slavery called debt peonage, which persisted in Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and other parts of the Deep South well into the 1940s. Federal investigations into neo-slavery in Florida uncovered numerous abuses of kidnapping and enslavement and led to a 1942 indictment and trial of a sugar plantation company in the Everglades. Lake County, too, needed as many workers as could be rounded up, and in 1944 elected a new sheriff to see to it. He was Willis Virgil McCall, the 6-foot-tall son of a dirt farmer who policed the county with a 10-gallon hat, size 13 boots, and a Winchester rifle he did not hesitate to cock. He was openly linked to white supremacists and would be implicated in the deaths and abuse of dozens of blacks in what would become a 28-year reign. As soon as he took office, he set to work. He arrested 40 pickers for vagrancy, including a man from Deacon Fashaw's crew in late January and early February 1945. They were arrested for not working on a Saturday, at a time when George, Sam, and Mudd were leading actual strikes in the groves. Each day, the danger was drawing closer, and there was now even more pressure on George's pickers to work, no matter how much George managed to win for them. McCall stepped up his arrests. In February, he showed up at the home of a picker from a crew in Leesburg, 15 miles west of Eustis. The picker, Mac Fryer, had already worked that week, but to the sheriff's way of thinking, the picker had no business being at home on a Saturday instead of out in the groves. McCall ordered Fryer to come with him. When he asked why, McCall replied, "None of your damn jaw, just come on with me." McCall struck the picker in the head with a blackjack for such impudence, knocking him unconscious in front of the picker's wife and 14-year-old son. He then hauled the picker to the Lake County Jail. The FBI began an investigation, and an agent was seen visiting the picker's wife, Annie. Local whites got wind of it and began plotting mob action because they saw her as stirring up trouble for the sheriff and the county by talking to the FBI. Neighbors warned the wife, and upon the picker's release, the Friars fled to Harlem, leaving all their possessions except some money from the sale of her chickens. George, now an unintended union organizer, somehow managed to stay under the radar screen for months, or so it appeared, in the 1,100 square miles of citrus land being policed by Sheriff McCall. But that could not go on forever. The orange groves had become a battlefield over more than just fruit, but over the rights of the people lowest down in the citrus world and the caste system itself, and the only thing that couldn't be known was how far George, Mud, and Sam could push it. For several days, late in the picking season, no rain fell from the sky. The limbs of the tangerine trees shrank in response. The stems became a tough rubber, harder to cut. Lil George and his crew landed in a tangerine grove out in Sanford in the middle of this unpleasant development. They hated picking tangerines. The fruit was small and it took more of them to fill a box. The very properties that made them easy to peel made them harder to pick. The rind broke and bruised almost at the touch, meaning it was harder to get a box of perfect tangerines. They had to be clipped flush without scraping the fruit, all while the picker was reaching between the branches and trying to steady himself on a limb. Then they had to be packed just so in the crate, so the stem of each tangerine wouldn't injure the rest. However difficult they were to pick, tangerines were big sellers at market. Growers in Lake County were known for holding down their production costs and thus netting returns to the grower considerably above the state average, according to a newspaper report. To do that, the grove owners were holding the pickers to nickels on a box, but with the war on, tangerines were selling an average of $4.40 a box at auction in 1944, nearly twice the going rate before the United States entered World War II. Across the state, tens of thousands of tangerines were being shipped out every week, a good portion of them coming out of Lake County. There were 2.6 million citrus trees in Lake County, the third most in the state next to Polk and Orange counties. George's crew arrived at the tangerine grove out in Sanford that morning. The foreman said the packing house would pay 10 cents a box. George said that wasn't enough, what with all they had to do and how hard it was to pick fragile tangerines in the best of conditions, which, after the lack of rain, these weren't. The price was always in flux, depending on the circumstances, anyway. This was one time where the pickers saw more work for themselves and thought the price should reflect that. So no, they needed 20 cents. The foreman held his ground. Lil George started to round up the pickers to head back home to see if 20 cents sounded better to the foreman than no tangerines at all. George told his crew to get back on the truck. "We're going back to town." "Well, we done come all this far now," they said. "We may as well work today and then we won't come back tomorrow." This was always the hard part. The pickers liked the miracle money on the days when the foreman gave in. But when the foreman turned them down, they were scared to leave with ill will in the air. What was the point of antagonizing the boss man? Let's go on and work while we're out here. But George knew that walking out was the only leverage they had. "Nope, we're not going to work today," George told the pickers. "We are not going to work today. Now, you made enough money yesterday. You already made more in one day than you make in a week doing day's work. You ain't never made over $6 a week. Yesterday, you made $7, $8, $9. So you're not losing anything. You gaining. So you can afford to go home and sit down today. Now, we not picking." The pickers didn't move. "What are you worried about?" George asked them. "Just take it easy." "Well, we done warmed our pail. So now you don't have to cook. Just take that on back home and eat." Word got back to the owner of the grove that there was trouble in the tangerine stands, and he came out to the field himself. He demanded to know why they were standing there, not picking. We not gonna pick tangerines for less than 20 cents a box, George told him. The man cursed and called them names. He had a gun on him like many a man, colored and white, in those parts at that time, and told them he would use it if he had to. George Mutt and Sam knew from hunting squirrel and possum how to handle a gun, too, and told him as much. The pickers, too frightened to speak, watched the standoff between George and the grove owner, not knowing how far either of them would take this thing, or how all of them would manage to get out of this. The men came to no agreement. The owner stormed back to his truck and sped away in a cloud of dust down an alley of his unpicked tangerine trees. George tried to step onto the flatbed truck to head back to town with his pickers. The foreman pushed him off. "No, boy," he said. "Y'all can't work. You ain't gone ride. These others can go back on here, but you ain't going back on there." The pickers were scared to get on the truck, and scared not to. "Y'all go ahead," George said. "Don't worry about me. Go on and get in the truck. You ride. I'll get back to town. Don't worry about me. Just get on the truck." He hitched a ride back to town and wondered how long his little union would hold. Fear spread among little George's band of pickers after that losing day in the tangerine groves. The owner had come out and seen them not picking. All these walkouts, and there might come a time when the packing house wouldn't let them work at all. The boss men might blame them for the fruit hanging unpicked in the trees. A picker would end up hanging from a tree himself before long if this kept up. They talked among themselves when George, Mud, and Sam weren't around. They didn't like how George in particular had a way of being what they considered impudent with white people in a way that made everyone nervous. Things had gone too far, as the other pickers saw it. These boys had been up north and were going to get all of them killed. That night, after the defeat over the tangerines, they went in secret to the owners of the grove. "Us come by to tell y'all how come us didn't work today," they said. "Them boys, Sam and Mud and Lil' George, you know them is bad. Them boys is bad. We know y'all has always done a good part by us colored folks, and we wanted to work. But them boys told us if we put a ladder in their tree, they gonna snatch the ladder up and stomp us when we hit the ground. So we scared. We know y'all is good white folks and has always done a good part by us. And it wasn't none of us." Sometime later, a young man was tending the grove owner's yard. He was clearing debris around the garage when he heard voices inside. They were the voices of grove owners talking among themselves about people on the colored side of town, something about the trouble some men were causing in the groves. The yard man recognized the name of Little George Starling. Schoolboy had helped him fill out ration papers for sugar and gasoline. It was wartime, and he wouldn't have gotten any if he didn't have papers, and he wouldn't have had papers if George hadn't filled them out for him. That night after work, the yard man went to Little George. "Little George, I come to tell you what I heard them saying about you boys today in the garage up there," he said. George looked at him and listened. "I heard them plotting that they gonna take you boys out," he said. "Say if they get rid of you three, that the rest of them they could handle. Say 'cause y'all got a big influence over their mothers. And so they scared of y'all, so they planning to get rid of y'all." The yard man said he heard mention of a cypress swamp 18 miles out from town. "They talking about taking y'all out to Blackwater Creek," he said. "They talking about giving y'all a necktie party. They gonna take y'all out there and hang y'all in one of them cypress trees." Something in George half expected as much. The man went on. "I thought I would tell you, 'cause you always were nice to me," he said. "When I had papers to fill out, I would bring my papers to you. You would always do it for me. You never charged me anything. And I wanted you to know. I came out here to tell you, y'all better watch yourself." "I appreciate that," George told him, not wanting to betray the churning in his stomach. "Man, I ain't studying about them people. Inside was a different story. I couldn't rest comfortable, he said. Leaving was his only option. He went to tell his father. Big George was trying to set out a little grove of his own at a place called Grand Island, 5 or 6 miles out from town. He had just put his orange trees in the ground and had to haul water out to them to soak them so they could catch root. Lil George helped him haul lake water in barrels. Together they poured the pails of water at the roots of the trees every evening. Out in the grove that night, Lil George told him his plans. After today, I'm not going to be able to help you haul no water, he said. I'll help you water these trees, then I'm going to get my clothes together, and I'm going to take on off, because I'm not going to change. He told his father what his father already knew. Men had been hanged for far less than what George was orchestrating, and there would be no protecting him if he stayed. In Florida and in the rest of the Deep South, the killing of a Negro by a white man ceased in practice even to call for legal inquiry, a white Southerner observed in the early 1940s. George and his father lived with that reality every day of their lives, and now it was right before them. So the best thing for me to do, George told his father, is to get on out from around here. Fort Polk, Louisiana, early 1953. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. By the time his tour of duty in Austria was over, Pershing had worked his way to a position of esteem, if not authority, and won awards for his medical skills. He had worked long hours, odd hours, building up his reputation, but it had left him no further ahead. Most Southern hospitals wouldn't allow him inside an operating room, no matter how gifted he was or what he'd done in the Army. There was simply no place for a high-minded colored surgeon who thought he was as good as, or to hear him tell it, better than most anybody else. He was now discharged to Fort Polk, Louisiana, and with no job prospects and a family to support, was plotting his escape from the world he had known. But where? And to what? He stayed awake at night weighing the options. All this education and no place to practice and live out his life as he imagined it to be. The only assurance of a job was back home in Monroe. Madison would be overjoyed to have his little brother join his small town practice, but Louisiana was out of the question. In the time Pershing had been away, the Fosters had lost their place as the leading and often resented colored family in Monroe. His mother, Audie, had passed away. His father, Professor Foster, had been edged out of his position as principal of Monroe Colored High School, to which he had devoted most of his adult life and identity. He had been forced into retirement and had to watch as a younger rival from his own faculty, Henry Carroll, not only ascended to the principal's desk, but also through carefully tended connections to a former governor of Louisiana, James A. Noe, managed to get a new colored high school built and named after himself. Robert watched the school go up and grieved for his heartbroken father. Just being a Foster in Monroe was like being in exile now. Besides, Alice had no interest in that small town. She wouldn't stand for it, and Pershing couldn't bear it. He could return to Alice's home in Atlanta. The Clements would be beside themselves, and that was the problem. Dr. Clement could surely set him up in practice, and Alice and Pershing could join colored society as the daughter and son-in-law of a distinguished university president. They would have a place card calligraphied for them whenever dignitaries came to visit. Eleanor Roosevelt, the Rockefellers, and so forth. They would have everything they aspired to, but at what price? He imagined he couldn't so much as choose the seasoning on the roast with Dr. Clement down the street. As it was, Dr. Clement was growing in prominence in Atlanta, looming larger than ever before, running for the Board of Education, seeking to become the first colored holder of a major office since Reconstruction. Back in medical school, Pershing had begun suspecting he had lost his place as the man in his family. While he was away learning to be a doctor, the family grew accustomed to Pershing's absence, had settled into routines and ways of being that could not be turned off overnight. Alice and the girls were living in President Clement's brick Georgian mansion, with its circular driveway and Doric columned veranda, its groundskeepers and servants, its chintz draperies and damask upholstery in grand parlors and receiving rooms. There, dignitaries gathered for tea, and in the evenings, Dr. Clement read to his beloved granddaughters in a club chair by the fireplace, pictures of the girls on the mantel next to the porcelain figurines. The Clements and Alice would gather the girls around the baby grand to sing along as Alice played. Bunny and Robin had become adorable little girls in pigtails and ribbons and patent leather shoes, but Pershing didn't truly know them. He had missed the milestones in their lives, their first steps, their first words, their first day of school. It was the Clements who dried their tears when they fell and went over their homework with them. Pershing could not blame anyone for what had become of his role in the family. He had agreed to the arrangement. Now he decided he needed to get as far from the Clements as he could to take possession of the family that was slipping from his influence. Atlanta was in the South, anyway. Atlanta was off the list. He sat down and tried to figure out, where else did he know anybody? There must be some place outside the South he could go. In the years since World War I, a large colony of colored people from Monroe had established themselves in Detroit. Faroker Johnson was one hometown man he knew. He was a dentist who had preceded him at Meharry and was practicing up in River Rouge. Then there was his boyhood friend, Nimrod Sherman. He was a psychiatrist up in Detroit and doing all right for himself. But Detroit didn't have the sophistication Pershing was looking for, and he didn't consider it for very long. Same for St. Louis, where he had done his residency, and even Chicago, which was cold besides. What he wanted was New York, where they never turned the lights out and had the best of anything you could think of. But he didn't know anybody there. That wasn't the natural route people from Louisiana took to get out of the South. They went where the railroad took them, straight north to Chicago and Detroit, or west to California, where the climate was more to their liking. So Pershing would have to think west, which was not a difficult thing to do. He had been hearing about California all his life, played pretend with Clara Poe, and always said he was going to California before he even knew what it was. Seemed like everybody who left Monroe was talking California. There was a contingent up in Oakland, a branch down in Los Angeles, spreading out to Fresno and over to San Bernardino. He had names, lots of names, more than enough to make a practice out of. Not only was it out of the South, it was about as far as you could get from the South and the Clements, too. He began to get excited at the very thought. No more stepping to the side door to get your meal like a hog at a trough. No more operations in somebody's kitchen and lynchings in the next county. He could dress like he wanted, act like he wanted, be who he wanted and how he wanted to be it. He would not have to try to protect his daughters from some planter with snuff in his mouth, and no, he couldn't. In California, he could stand up straight and not apologize for it. He would know what white people's water tasted like and drink it whenever he wanted. It wasn't one thing. It was everything. He was going to be a citizen of the United States, like the passport said. He told Alice his decision. They could start out fresh in California, the four of them. He would go first and see it for himself. She and the girls would stay in Atlanta for now, and she could start packing their belongings. He would send for them after he got settled. All he had to do now was save a little money and figure how best to get out.